Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. On this episode, Lieutenant Colonel Badger Underwood sits down with Brigadier General Jonathan Rice, the Director of Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Operations within the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for ISR and Cyber Effects Operations at the Pentagon. They discuss information warfare, the functions and capabilities of information warfare, and the challenges to conducting information warfare in the current digital age. Please join us.
General Rice, thank you so much for being here. This is the end of the day after Artificial Intelligence Symposium here at LeMay Center. And what a better time to talk about information warfare with AI being a set of disciplines that not only increase that capability, but also bring the dream of what we would like to be able to do in information warfare. It brings that to a reality, and it also highlights a lot of the changes that are currently happening in this space. So I think this is a great time to talk about it. I'm really happy you agreed to sit down with us. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Badger. I can't tell you how excited I am to have this opportunity to sort of sit down and talk through an area that I'm really passionate about. We're at this inflection point in the changing character of warfare, and information warfare is really at the heart of much of that change. And so this is a really important area for us to all learn more about, to explore, and to better understand. And so I just greatly appreciate the opportunity to sit down and talk with you about it for a few minutes.
Appreciation's all mine, sir. I think we'll start, as any good academic paper does, is kind of defining our terms. Right now, I make the joke that in the English language, we have a million words, and somehow in doctrine, we find a way to use the same six ones over and over again. At the joint level, I think they use operations information environment. We talk about the information joint function. But information warfare, from where you sit, has a very specific meaning. And I thought we might talk about what is information warfare and what is your team trying to accomplish?
Yeah. You know, that's a really key element of the whole discussion is to get everyone sort of calibrated so we're actually talking about the same thing at the same time. And as you mentioned, there's a fair number of terms that are out there. The relatively new joint publication 3-04 that came out talks about information and joint operations. Our own relatively recent, you know, doctrine talks about information in Air Force operations. Certainly operations in the information environment, particularly in joint publications, is pretty prevalent, and we use it in the Air Force. The joint doctrine community has decided not to use the term information warfare. But I think it's really valuable for us and that we've chosen in the Air Force to use that term because it's a comprehensive enough term to cover all of those areas that we just mentioned and bring them together into a coherent framework so that we can then make choices about what are the activities we're actually talking about, how do we integrate them together, what are the underlying capabilities that enable us to execute or conduct those activities, and what are the outcomes that we're looking for based on that? Because the information environment itself is in this state of change. And so this is a coherent way for us to think about what the implications of that are for military operations.
It's interesting you talk about reflection point and state of change. You mentioned to me earlier when I approached you about doing this podcast, you said, well, it's not new. This is as old, at least Sun Tzu. I'm interested, what has changed and why has suddenly this new terminology come about? Are there new activities or new outcomes? Is it all new? What's really changed that makes it so important for us to understand this?
In this changing context or the changing character of warfare, changing character of warfare that we're talking about is happening on a larger tapestry of the world in which we live and the changes that the broader society is going through. Among those are several key things that are changing the character of the information environment in and through which most information warfare activity happens. There's a lot of specific aspects to it, but here's a couple of trending areas that, you know, that we should consider that are changing the nature of the information environment and therefore both the opportunities and the threats that are posed to us as we think about the implications for military operations. Certainly, you mentioned, hey, we're at this conference, a symposium this week on artificial intelligence, and really the emergence and significant maturation of machine learning over the last couple of years is really prevalent in that discussion. because it's opening up the potential, not just for us to do things we've done before more better and faster, but it's creating the possibility for us to now do things that we could not have otherwise done, but for the technological capabilities that are becoming available to us through the maturation of machine learning. That in and of itself is becoming possible because of some other underlying technologies. So part of it has to do with the ubiquitous nature of communication networks and the ability to move data around a lot. Part of it has to do with the explosion of high-power computing capability, which gives us the opportunity to actually do some really sophisticated, novel things with all the data. And part of it has to do with the underlying cloud computing ecosystem that's now pretty prevalent, that again allows us to move data, store data, compute with data, and do it simultaneously with many people who are at distant locations, but can coordinate with the same set of information commonly. All of that sort of is converging together to create not just machine learning, but the creation and existence of what we would refer to as big data and the advanced analytics that you can do when you have this thing that we call big data available to us. In addition to that, you have the explosion of social media, not a particularly new phenomenon. It's been around for a couple of decades now, but in combination with all the other things that I just mentioned, social media itself is both moving information, in some cases misinformation, in some cases intentional disinformation, moving it around pretty quickly to really wide audiences, and is also responsible for explosion in the volume of information that's created in the world. Another trend that we see is ubiquitous sensing capabilities, maybe ISR capabilities in the military context, not just that we have, but that our adversaries now more and more have, particularly in the context of great power competition. And so it's not just our ability to do stuff with data, but it's our adversary's ability to essentially do all the same kinds of things. And so therefore, that poses a new type of threat environment that we now have to contend with. And I think we should recognize that for some of our most significant adversaries, sometimes in the American way of war, we think of we're at war or we're not at war. But as it turns out, our adversaries don't tend to think in those same sort of stark terms. And so often from their perspective, we're already in the conflict. We're definitely in conflict with them every day right now in the information environment. We're in that conflict with them in an economic sense, in a legal sense, in a social sense. At some point, whether that turns into a kinetic shooting conflict or not, in some ways, our American military tradition sort of treats that as a very distinct entry into armed conflict. Our adversaries, in many cases, just see that as a natural progression of the conflict that's already underway. So that's really important to us from an information warfare perspective, because information warfare is underway right now. And therefore, it behooves us to ensure that we are effective in the information environment right now and continuously across time, so that as we shift sort of through varying degrees of intensity of the spectrum of conflict or competition, then we can still prevail in competition. We can maintain our military advantage and increase our ability to de-escalate things in crisis. And if circumstances warrant, we have the ability to prevail in conflict as well. But all that comes with a requirement for us to be really adept and agile in all the aspects of information warfare that we're talking about today.
It's interesting, that line of armed conflict, that's where we want to be. Traditional military, the idea of that's where we're going to be, that's where we're going to train. And we'd start talking about this competition continuum, this idea of, I hesitate to even say conflict because there's so much around it. That comment I made earlier, that doctrine, we found a way to use six of the million words available. Even information warfare itself starts to sound as if, well, this is only war. And so you end up with this very complex idea. And so it's almost better to just step back, open up the aperture and go, look, we can be in conflict that may not meet your traditional definition of warfare. I think that's quite profound to think of it that way, especially since our adversaries don't bother with these exacting definitions. They're much more contextual. Absolutely. I think that's an excellent point. Since we are in the AI symposium here, what you've outlined here is this nonlinear change, nearly this explosion. And it sounds like a lot of that has to do with just the amount of data that's out there, the technology that's out there. And so a lot of this change looks like it's happening in a nonlinear way. And so the academic way that says, oh, well, it's due to Moore's law and the amount of information is growing every single day. Is it really that simple?
You know, Badger, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, we were talking a lot about network-centric warfare.
Yeah.
Because of the emergence of the communications technologies of the 1990s, cellular phones became really prevalent. In fact, in some underdeveloped countries, their cellular phone system became better than their landline system because they didn't really have a robust, reliable landline system. But as the technology evolved, it became easier to actually establish cellular networks and cell towers, and people could more easily get cell phones. And, you know, not necessarily everywhere, but that was a contributing factor to rapid democratization of global communications capability that occurred about 25 years ago or so. The internet had really taken off and became not a niche thing, but really got commercialized. And we went through the tech bubble of the late 1990s, where huge amounts of money were invested in all the dot-com tech startups that became prevalent. And massive amounts of money were dumped into building cyberspace as we know it today.
Right.
Not just commercialization, but accessibility by individuals to the internet, to the World Wide Web, to cellular communications, eventually to 3G, 4G, and now 5G mobile communications. The emergence of social media as a way by which people would communicate all contributed to our view of sort of a network-centric way of this sort of information environment. But what's happened really even beyond that gets to, you know, your point about the data itself. As we mature beyond the presence of these ubiquitous communications networks or capabilities to the digitalization of the data itself, then it does cause us to begin thinking about this from a data-centric perspective rather than merely a network-centric perspective. And that has implications for us in terms of what does the information environment look like and what opportunities does that create? It doesn't mean that the networks are no longer relevant. Absolutely, 100% they are. It just now means that the explosion of the total volume and the grand variety of digitalized information, we'll call it data, that's out there and available and is streaming into people's homes and mobile devices and government systems and militaries is, again, we're at that inflection point where, I mean, it's really taking off, and the reflecting changing nature of that information environment is playing out in the changing character of warfare. But warfare, as we describe, not just when we're in the kinetic armed conflict, but really throughout the spectrum of competition, crisis, and conflict.
And yeah, we don't really have another word other than warfare. We got a million of them, but warfare seems to fit. But we are talking about across the competition continuum. I'd like to talk a little bit about some components of it and some capabilities and what we're actually trying to achieve inside of information warfare itself. You kind of laid out the line that we built this network. And through this network, as it grew, more and more data and information got into it. And suddenly, that data and information becomes extremely important to control, to understand, to interpret, to, I'm sure I'm using all the wrong verbs. I'm interested to see, okay, now that we see the focal point becomes that data and information, how do we approach using that to accomplish an end state?
So what I would offer to you is a framework for how we think about information warfare. We have a formal definition that the Air Force has adopted that goes something to the effect of information warfare is the employment of military capabilities in and through the information environment to deliberately affect adversary human and system behavior and to preserve friendly freedom of action, again, across the spectrum of conflict. And that's all accurate and true. But let me pose it to you another way. I'll offer to you three lenses through which to look at information warfare. The first and the simplest is, what are information warfare capabilities? Again, in the Air Force, we've chosen to sort of describe those in terms of six specific capability areas. What makes these things information warfare capabilities is essentially they meet two criteria. The first is they're inherently informational in and of themselves. And the second is they directly contribute to one of the four information warfare functions. Let me come back to the functions. Here's the seven capabilities as we've defined them. ISR and targeting, cyber effects operations, public affairs, information operations, which includes operational security, military information support operations, and military deception, operations analysis and data science, weather, and electromagnetic spectrum operations. Those are sort of the seven key areas that we characterize as information warfare capabilities. Some of them produce effects directly, like cyber effects operations or electromagnetic spectrum operations. Some of them are more designed to provide information for the purpose of achieving effects or one of the intended outcomes, like, you know, intelligence or weather, things like that. But collectively, we consider these information warfare capabilities. Each of those seven directly contribute to one of the four functions of information warfare. And here's how I would describe the four functions. Imagine that you have this quad chart with sort of the two axes, right? And from left to right, on the left side, you're oriented towards blue forces, and on the right side of this chart, you're oriented towards red forces. So that dimension or dynamic has to do with who are you focused on, the good guys or the bad guys? The other axis, if you will, in this quad chart is focused on which dimension of information are we talking about? Are we talking about the cognitive dimension, the thinking, the decision-making, the analysis, or are we talking about the technical dimension, by which we mean the information or data itself, the systems that process this information, or the networks that move the information around, right? So if you think about that, then if we're talking about the adversary's cognitive part of the information environment, then we would think about the function of influence. Our goal from an information warfare perspective is to influence adversary behavior. Largely, that is done through nudging adversary perceptions, but affecting their behavior through this cognitive dimension of the information environment. If instead we were focused on the technical aspects of the information environment with regards to our adversary, then we would talk about attack, meaning how do we disrupt, deny, degrade, maybe manipulate the adversary's information environment to impact their ability to sort of freely operate in the information environment and what actions they're able to take based on that. Conversely, right, if we wanted to think about that from the blue perspective, we would be thinking about how do we defend our own technical aspects of the information environment. And, you know, for both the adversary and our own friendly forces, when we're thinking about these technical aspects in terms of military operations, we're mostly thinking about C5ISRT, command, control, communications, computers, cyberspace, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and targeting. So C5ISRT, weapon systems, or critical infrastructure, right? And so those are the three big categories of technical aspects of the information environment that we primarily think about, not exclusively, but we're primarily focused on those things from an information warfare perspective. Finally, if we're thinking about how do we best affect Blue's cognitive dimension, our own cognitive dimension, then we're thinking about the function of perform. right? So this is the quad chart: influence, attack, defend, and inform. And so you achieve or you conduct each of those functions with the information warfare capabilities, but not exclusively with the information warfare capabilities. You can accomplish those functions in the information environment with many other military capabilities as well. Usually to achieve one of those four effects, we're integrating a variety of capabilities, some of them being information warfare capabilities and some of them not being. But it's how we integrate them together in aggregate that we're able to achieve one of those four functions: influence, attack, defend, or inform. So that's the second lens to think about information warfare. The third one would be to think about information warfare from the perspective of the outcomes we're seeking by conducting one of those four functions. And really, this is how it all comes together. From a blue perspective, we're looking to take our observe, orient, decide, act loop, or OODA loop, and tighten it. We want to make it faster, more resilient, more precise. And we want to take the adversary's OODA loop, and we want to slow it, degrade it, or manipulate it. And in so doing, we create a delta between the two things. A favorable delta, right, if we do it right, so that the differential between our tightly orchestrated, fast, precise, resilient OODA loop and an adversary's slow, degraded, manipulated OODA loop becomes our decision space, our decision advantage. And so those are the outcomes we're trying to achieve through the execution of those four functions. Let's tighten ours and make it smaller, tighter, faster. Let's expand theirs, make it slower, less reliable, more degraded, manipulated in our favor. And through the collective outcomes of those influence, attack, defend, and inform actions that we take, then we'll achieve decision advantage. But it's not a one-time event, right? So you have to continue this through everything that you're doing so that you're able to sustain that decision advantage in a continuous way. And again, not just in that armed conflict circumstance, but you know, throughout competition, crisis, and whatever form of conflict is underway at the moment.
It's interesting. In doctrine, we use the word, you said, multiple components. In the joint language, it becomes multiple supporting and supported commanders as we try to interleave that web. For instance, a Kabul airlift, you end up with a bunch of supporting commanders and supported. And if we end up with large global conflicts, you end up with these strange relationships that end up happening between all of these COCOMs. And that's one of the questions that I didn't get a chance to ask at the last AFA, but I'm very curious whether or not Goldwater Nichols, the way in which we actually have set up our COCOMs, if there's rethinking that has to happen there because of all that interplay. It's a much larger question than any of us can answer, but one of the things that I think is super important is we get to IW and we talk about across the competition continuum. I imagine your office spends a great deal of time talking about the four-letter word authorities, because that's exactly what you end up having to unravel when you start talking about, you know, this sandbox versus that sandbox, this chain of command versus that chain of command. Knowing that that's something you guys battle constantly, maybe we could talk about the roadblocks that you run into trying to meet the challenges of this digital age and what you're trying to accomplish in information warfare.
Badger, right now, I spend a fair amount of my time working with the command, control, communications, battle management community, C3BM community, and the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, or ISR community. Both C2 and ISR, vital functions, core functions.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right, in the Air Force. You can imagine conceptually, there was a time way back when the two worlds sort of existed independently of one another. They had points of transaction, but that was it, right? I mean, it was a transactional relationship. Mm-hmm. The two worlds or communities did what they did really, really well. And what they negotiated was what their points of transaction, what contracts they would have in place to ensure that the command and control community could convey to the intel community what information it needed. and the intelligence community could convey back to the command and control community that information in a timely manner so that it could action it, right? And this worked great. And again, in the industrial age of several decades ago, we optimized for this and we got really good at it. Over time, those touch points became more and more, so much so that they became largely indistinguishable as individual touch points and more as a boundary layer.
Oh.
So much so that the command and control world and the ISR world shared a very tightly interwoven boundary where information flowed between them really well, but they were still two different worlds. The implications of what we just talked about, that was optimized for the speed, precision, and scale of the industrial age, but it's not optimized for the speed, precision, and scale of the digital age. And so for us to achieve a much more iterative, interdependent, and integrated relationship that's required for our military operations to succeed in this world, they will have to be meshed much more closely together. Not one subordinated to the other or one eliminated in favor of the other, but the two very important functions of command and control and ISR nested together very tightly. Our institutions are bureaucratic artifacts, and I don't mean that pejoratively. I just mean the systems we put in place to build the wonderful capabilities that we benefited from for decades served us well, but they're not the ones that we need in order to achieve that iterative, interdependent, integrated, not just interoperable set of capabilities and operational functionality that's required. So let's think about a couple of them. The technical design choices that we previously made for C2 systems and for ISR systems are each good, but were done separately. The programmatics associated with funding and resourcing each are good, but generally done separately. The policies for security, including cybersecurity, are very strong and robust, but done separately. The training for how to use both the technology and the TTP or SOPs, the operational concepts for each of them, are very robust, but generally done separately. And so the challenge for us now is how to ensure that we preserve the full functionality of ISR, because ISR does many things other than directly feed C2 that the military is dependent upon. C2 is dependent upon many things beyond ISR in order to be able to effectively direct our forces. But these two things must coexist and be really integrated well together. And so those are the types of changes that, as we optimize for a great power competition, and this great power competition that exists in this evolving, quickly evolving digital age in which we now live, these are the type of systems or bureaucratic artifacts or organizational structures that we're going to have to wrestle with and think through in order to preserve the robust functionality of both C2 and ISR while nesting them together really, really tightly. And so we need some really bright minds thinking through how to do that in a smart, effective way that optimizes us for this changing character of warfare, a changing character of warfare where we have to think not just kinetic, but non-kinetic operations, including some of the information warfare capabilities, cyber effects operations, influence operations, electronic warfare activities. We have to think through how we do that sort of seamlessly across the spectrum of competition, crisis, and conflict. We have to think how we do that when our adversary poses to us a threat we've never faced before. Our biggest adversaries will soon be able to pose to us the ability to control their own forces across domains, across willy ride geographic areas, and at great distance in pretty sophisticated ways. We haven't really faced an adversary that could effectively do that before. We'll have to do it where we are contested in every aspect of our military operations, from our home stations in the continental United States, while we're projecting forces forward, we're deploying them, we're trying to get airborne, we're trying to gain air superiority, we're trying to deny the adversary their objectives, we're trying to sustain the fight, right? As we go through all aspects of military operations, again, this nesting will have to occur.
I brought the idea of authorities up. A lot of times the authorities comes to this idea of ownership. You know, I own this, and that's where a lot of the teeth get gnashed when they have those conversations. And you're talking about we have to interweave these things. And a lot of times that discussion of ownership actually slows things down instead of getting the job done. I've been playing with an analogy on my head. You talk about decision superiority, and I think that your discussion earlier on getting ready for the digital age gets as close to this idea of decision superiority definition that I've heard, because everybody wants to avoid specific definitions, but it's really interesting. And I've been playing with this idea of just-in-time logistics, meaning just-in-time decisions, so about getting the information to the decision maker at the point that they need it. And a lot of what you're talking about reminds me of just-in-time logistics, where you take a company like Amazon, where shipping and warehouse storage were two separate things. But what they started doing was keeping products in constant rotation and shipping throughout the country in order to meet their two-day piece. And so, you know, with your shipping being your command and control and your warehouse being your information, by getting that information flowing around constantly in the command and control and that overlap being a constant thing, I don't know, it may be a broken analogy, but it seems to work in my head. So hopefully I've not confused you too much. As we get towards the end here, kind of give you an opportunity. We've talked a lot about information warfare and some of those capabilities and ends. Let me start by saying thank you for being here, because I want your last words to be last words on the podcast. If you're talking to the FGOs, the senior NCOs that are trying to lead and come up in this environment, that they're dealing with challenges, they don't really have a template necessarily to understand. I can tell them it's a changing character of warfare, but I can't draw it on a board. We're saying, hey, you're this industrial age model that you're familiar with. We can't use that. We have to figure out how to do this differently. What are some words to lead in that environment to try to understand the challenges really that they're coming after? What are you telling your guys, I guess, is what I would say is, here's our world. How do we conceptualize this?
Badger, I would offer this to our field grade officers, senior NCOs, or others, as they're wrestling with this and figuring out for our Air Force, what does this mean in really practical terms? What are they supposed to do with this? We need their expertise. We need their creativity and innovative thinking. What I would offer to them as a way to embrace this journey is embrace the idea of systems thinking. I think the Secretary of the Air Force and the Chief of Staff have really pointed us in a good direction with this regards. Historically, we've been really good in thinking along the terms of more specific stovepiped areas. We were really good about thinking about very specific weapon systems and employing weapon systems. Tactically amazing. We're really good at operating at the operational level of warfare. World's best at that. Phenomenal. Although our adversaries are catching up. The area, though, that we need to get much better at, and if our field grade officers and senior NCOs can begin seeing the world through this lens, then I think it will allow them to step up to that next level in figuring out what the practical implications of this are, is to think about the adversary's system of systems so that our success is less defined by, did we have the tactical effect against a specific target, as an example? And rather think about it, did the aggregate effect of our many actions impact the adversary's system in the way we needed it to, at the time we needed it to, for the duration of time that we needed it to. In other words, don't just think about the adversary's specific weapon systems, but think about their ability to conduct operations at that operational level war. Are we able to affect their C5ISRT architecture? Are we able to affect their long-range kill chains? Are we able to affect their ability to sustain their forces? Are we able to affect their ability to communicate data through across their ubiquitous communications layers? Similarly, think about our own blue capabilities as systems of systems. So how do we integrate together electronic attack, offensive cyberspace operations, and kinetic strikes in a coherent way that collectively those activities have the desired outcome that we're looking for? Are we able to muster together our logistical capabilities so that we can deploy and sustain the force when we're contested in every aspect of those logistical operations? Are we fielding a robust and resilient set of communication systems, decision-making tools, and sensing capabilities so that we can command and control our forces writ large? And so, yes, of course, it'll still remain important that we're very tactically proficient in each individual system, but that will no longer be sufficient. We'll have to become much more proficient at how to integrate everything together. And then when any one part of it happens to be degraded, the system is still effective and able to continue operating forward. But that puts an onus on each airman then to more fully understand things outside their own specific specialization or area of expertise. And I think that's probably one of the biggest areas that we as an Air Force will need to focus on as we develop those more senior officers and senior NCOs, is fostering that understanding from a system of systems perspective rather than just stovepipe perspectives. Hey, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the opportunity to address this particular topic. I think it's really fundamental to where we're going. And thanks, Badger, for teeing this up and just having a great conversation with me today.
This has been awesome. Thank you, sir.
This concludes this week's podcast. This show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach Section. Special thanks to General Rice, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our panel members are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. We will see you next time.